welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson, your host with the most... Oh, I can't believe I just said that, but I did. Anyway, it's not hard to tell that, we're over a year. Actually, I think this time last year was the last time we kind of recorded an episode of the show in the CFRU studio, having come from a movie we had just watched in the movie theater, and then the pandemic came along and washed all that away, and now I sit here alone in Guelph Politico headquarters here on beautiful Snake Mountain, recording all by myself, except when I get Tim Phillips on the line, and he will be helping us do this week's review. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the news movies, which this week will be the new 70s set crime drama, I'm Your Woman, which you can now stream on Amazon Prime Video. Sadly for everyone involved, though, in I'm Your Woman, they were not nominated for any Oscars. There were the Oscar nominations announced on Monday, this past Monday. The show will be going live on April 25th, and that will again be probably a socially distant show of some description. I know a lot of people, maybe some of you out there, watched the Grammy Awards on this past weekend, and that was a socially distant ceremony. I think they had like five different stages all over the place, five different venues. They had some pre-recorded segments, so that seemed to go off pretty good for them. But back to the Oscars, the nominations were announced on Monday, as I said, and Mank is the leading contender. It has 10 nominations, including Best Picture. That should not be terribly surprising. It was probably, even though it was released on Netflix, probably like the biggest movie released last year that was almost definitely going to get Oscar consideration, because it's a Hollywood movie about Hollywood, about Hollywood's golden past, directed by one of Hollywood's golden boys in the form of David Fincher, featuring Gary Oldman, a renowned actor who has been rewarded at least once with an Oscar already, and he might be again. There were six movies tied for second with the most nominations, with six nominations apiece, so six for six, which is interesting in a way, too. There were eight Best Picture nominees this year. As a reminder, they can nominate upwards of 10. They usually top out at 9, but in this year they have chose 8. And they are The Father, Judas and the Black Messiah, Mank, Minari, No Man Land, Promising Young Woman, Sound of Metal, and The Trial of the Chicago 7. That's a pretty solid lineup with no real kind of surprises, I think. For actor in a leading role, we have Riz Ahmed, Chadwick Boseman, Anthony Hopkins, Gary Oldman, and Steven Yeun. Steven Yeun's an interesting choice. He's the first Asian-American actor to be nominated for lead actor. So that is like one of numerous history-making things that are going on in this ceremony. Another is Anthony Hopkins is the oldest person to be nominated for Best Actor Oscar. Chadwick Boseman, if he were to win, he would be... Well, actually, he's already got this. He's the seventh person to be nominated for an acting Oscar posthumously. Of course, sadly, Chadwick Boseman died last summer. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is his last film. And I think it's pretty easy to say that this is going to be his to beat, sadly. Although I think Riz Ahmed offers some pretty strong competition. We'll have to see how it turns out. Actress in a leading role. This is Viola Davis's record-breaking 4th Oscar nomination. She is the most nominated black actress in Oscar history now. She used to be tied with her Help co-star Octavia Spencer. They both had 3. Now Viola Davis has 4. She also is the only black actress with 2 Best Actress nominations, which is incredible. No stranger to nominations herself. You have Frances McDormand nominated for Nomadland, Carey Mulligan for Promising Young Woman, Vanessa Kirby for Pieces of a Woman, and Audra Day for The United States versus Billie Holiday, which was when Audra Day was nominated for the Golden Globe. It was kind of a spoiler choice because not a lot of people were aware of that movie or had seen it yet. I think it only recently came available on VOD. But she then won the Golden Globe, so there's a lot of eyes on her now. For Best Actor in a Supporting Role, we have Sacha Baron Cohen, Daniel Kaluuya, Leslie Odom Jr., Paul Racy. Amazing! Paul Racy, because he is so good in that film. I unfortunately somehow doubt he is going to win. But you never know. And then Lakeith Stanfield for Judas and the Black Messiah. I think Sacha Baron Cohen is... what am I going to say? He's kind of the flashy choice from that movie. Unfortunately, I think Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya might cancel each other out. So I think this might be a race between Paul Racy and Leslie Odom Jr. And I don't know who to root for in that race. It's like Rosemary's Baby. Oh, not Rosemary's Baby. What's the other one? Sophie's Choice. There we go. Best Supporting Actress, Maria Bakalova for Borat, Glenn Close for Hillbilly Elegy, Olivia Colman for The Father, Amanda Seyfried for Mank, and Yuzhong Yun, I hope that's how you pronounce that, for Minara. For my personal taste, I would love to see Maria Bakalova win. I think she's really... I don't think that movie works without her. And I think that's the definition of supporting role. If you do not have this actress in this role, the movie does not work. And I think that is Maria Bakalova in a nutshell. We'll get to Glenn Close in a minute because that's not all I have to say about her. For Best Director, we have Thomas Vinterberg for Another Round, Mank, David Fincher, Minari, Lee Isaac Chung, Nomadland, Chloe Zhao, and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman. Of course, Chloe Zhao is going into this with the benefit of the Golden Globe victory and a lot of critical praise for Nomadland. Got it in one that time. So I think she's probably going to be the one to beat here. Interestingly, she's the second woman. She would be the second woman to win an Oscar for Best Director and the first woman of color to win an Oscar if she does eventually win. Which is, you know, extraordinary. For Best Screenplay Adapted, there's Borat, a subsequent movie film. Interesting statistic. Borat and Borat subsequent movie film are the only sequel, or the only film and sequel to both get nominations for screenplay after The Godfather. So there's a little piece of Hollywood trivia that only Godfather and Borat share, is that the films and their sequels both nominated for screenplay nominations. The Father, Nomadland, One Night in Miami, and White Tiger round out that category. For original screenplay, you have Judas and the Black Messiah, Minari, Promising Young Woman, Sound of Metal, and Trial of the Chicago 7. I hope this is not a thing where they just give it to Aaron Sorkin because he's Aaron Sorkin, because the Trial of the Chicago 7 is not his best work, and he could have written that in his sleep. So just for some extra... I'm just looking at my notes here. So yeah, I talked about Steven Yeun. Here's another interesting thing. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, they are both nominated for original score twice, their Mank score, and their score for Pixar's Soul. So that is two very different soundtracks if you listen to them. But very, very great work by them, and it'll be interesting to see if they're able to win. So we have the Oscar nominations, but we also have the Razzie nominations. The Golden Raspberry Awards is this annual award for the worst movies that are given out at the same weekend as the Oscars. Interestingly, Glenn Close, nominated for Best Supporting Actress at the Oscars, also nominated for Worst Supporting Actress at the Razzies. This is not an unique development. She is the third person to be nominated for an Oscar and a Razzie for the same role. The other two are Amy Irving for Yentl and James Coco for Only When I Laugh. And those were both almost 30 years ago. It is possible, and it has been possible in the past, for people to be nominated for Oscars and Razzies, not necessarily for the same roles in the same year. Melissa McCarthy was the last person to do that. She was nominated for an Oscar for Can You Ever Forgive Me, and she was nominated for a Razzie for The Happy Time Murders. So, I mean, one of the things we talked about at the end of the year show, I mean, me and the Ed Credits co-host, it was hard to come up with a list of worst movies because, like, the really terrible stuff, it was kind of left on the shelf with the kind of typical stuff. A lot of big Hollywood releases that tend to finish dead last in the year in terms of if critical rankings, they were left on the shelf with a lot of the other Hollywood film, so it's kind of really hard to come out with a list, but somehow the Razzies have done it. For Worst Picture, they have 365 Days, Absolute Proof, Doolittle, Fantasy Island, and Music. If you don't recognize a lot of those titles, I understand. Music is the film directed by Sia, which has gotten derided for its depiction of people with autism spectrum issues. Fantasy Island, of course, was the dark, gritty remake of the old Ricardo Montalban series. Doolittle, the bloated remake of Dr. Doolittle, starring Robert Downey Jr. and a plethora of CG animals. Absolute Proof is this documentary that, I should use that in quote marks, that Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, made about election fraud in the 2020 U.S. presidential election. So, like, really easy pickings. And then you may have heard of 365 Days. It is a Polish movie that's essentially softcore porn. It's kind of 50 Shades-esque. Kind of more infamous for its, well, not explicit sex scenes, but sex scenes that kind of feel explicit or look explicit. Although the actors have fervently denied that there was real sex on the set. Anyway, if you go down the worst list, I mean, it's a lot of the usual suspects. For Worst Actor, we have RDJ for Doolittle, Mike Lindell for Absolute Proof, Michelle Morone for 365 Days, Adam Sandler for Hubie Halloween or Hubby Halloween. I don't know which ones that is. And then David Spade for The Wrong Missy. I mean, never a year goes by without having to dunk on Adam Sandler for the Razzies. And I understand he's made some odd choices in his life. Oh, here's another instance, although it's kind of jokey, wink wink here, of getting nominated for an Oscar on the same day you get nominated for a Razzie. Maria Bakalova and Rudy Giuliani are nominated for Worst Screen Combo in Borat Subsequent Movie Film. I have a feeling that is the Razzie organizers having a little fun, because that was a very funny sequence with Rudy Giuliani getting his just desserts in that regard. I do like this category because Adam Sandler and his grating simpleton voice for Hubby Halloween was also nominated. Harrison Ford and that totally fake-looking CGI dog in Call of the Wild. I concur on the totally fake-looking CGI dog. That was utterly distracting in the ads for Call of the Wild. Robert Downey Jr. and his utterly unconvincing, in quote marks, Welsh accent in Doolittle. Yes, I would concur with that as well. Maybe to wind things up this week, here's a couple other pieces of movie news. Billie Eilish became the first person to win a Grammy for a song in a movie that has not been released. She won a Grammy for the No Time to Die theme song. Avatar is now the highest grossing movie worldwide again. It was re-released in China, and Avengers Endgame had just kind of barely beat it when it left theaters in 2019, but now Avatar is back on top thanks to this Chinese re-release. And as many people have pointed this out, at the end of the day, all money goes to Disney anyway, so who cares? Speaking of Disney, a lot of people have been noting that Disney's been doing a lot of hardcore press, that's the word I'm looking for Cruella, this Cruella de Vil 101 Dalmatians prequel, live-action prequel that's coming out later this year. Haven't been seeing so much Black Widow promotion, even though Black Widow comes out 3 weeks before Cruella. At this point, they're still planning theatrical releases, although that's very much in doubt as long as COVID's along. So people are speculating if Marvel is anticipating, you know, maybe having to hold back Black Widow from theaters. That would probably create another cascading effect because there are four Marvel movies expected to be released this year. And speaking of theaters, domestic box office in the United States was up last week for the first time. I think it was 45% over 30% the week before. So a lot of people are taking this as a good sign that the box office is slowly coming back. Although, if ticket sales stay this way, they're anticipating $4.5 to $6 billion haul, which is about half of what the box office did in 2019, the last time there was a full year of releases. So keep that in your back pocket for later when we see how all this turns out. It's still only March. Who knows what might happen? I know what happens next, though. A musical break and then a review of I'm Your Woman. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
So I'm supposed to live, you don't know where, for you don't know how long, and also you don't know if Eddie's okay. Just let me call him, let him be the one to explain it.
You can't.
You're talking about my husband.
No one knows where he is. You can't call him because no one knows where he is.
Is anybody looking?
Everyone's looking. And they're looking for you too.
Nice house near a park. I like to take walks with a stroller.
And that was a clip from I'm Your Woman. It's the new film from Julia Hart, and it stars Rachel Brosnahan, Aaron Zine Kenney, Marcia Stephanie Blake, Bill Heck, Marceline Huguette, and Frankie Faison. I am now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. Spring's here. 1 year since pandemic started. It's quite the anniversary. Looking forward to a lot of the same for a little while, and then hopefully back to somewhat normal.
I was about to say, what are you looking forward to exactly? I mean, I guess maybe going outside when it's nicer, that's something worth looking forward to. But yeah. It's, I mean, there is slow progress. I signed up my mom online for pre-registration for the vaccine a couple of days ago. So
that's awesome.
That is progress. And yeah, we'll see what happens. And in the meantime, we're gonna keep doing this. So the movie we have chosen this week is I'm Your Woman. And Tim, you chose this, and you wanted to check this one out. So why don't we start with you? And what looked good about I'm Your Woman? What made you want to dig into this movie?
Right, yeah, Adam. So I picked this one. I was going through, I don't even remember what we watched this on, whether it was Prime or Netflix, but I was just going through the streaming service, and I was looking, and it's like, this looks interesting. And I know it was off the board from the selections we were looking at. So I was trying to be, you know, original, come up with something different. So I chose this, and I kind of regret it now.
Really?
I liked a lot of the movie, but at the end of the day, I don't know, it kind of felt a bit empty to me at the end. Like, there was a lot going on, and then I felt like it didn't really lead anywhere for me. But I wanted to try to find something. It had gotten really good reviews, and something, you know, outside the box that, you know, you had to dig a little bit to find, and low budget. And so I went with this, and it also said that it's inspired by 1970s films, takes place in the 70s. And I know in the last show I was mentioning how much I like 70s movies. I like a lot of them. It's weird why I like them. I like a lot of them because they're like dismal, sort of dead end stories, just character driven stories. And I thought this, given what I read, would be more like that. And I found it was set in the 70s and it had, you know, that gangster vibe about it, but it didn't really have that feel, which it's hard to reproduce that feel from movies that were actually made in the 70s that are just so honest and brutal that I like. This one, I felt like it had a lot of good elements and there were moments that drew me in, but then the payoffs just didn't do it for me at the end. I felt like there was a lot, I could almost see like the screenplay being developed where they're coming up with ideas and they're like, okay, this person actually is going to be related to this person, or they're going to have been married to this person. And I write some stuff, so I can see how you can fall in that trap. I find like when I'm ambitious in writing something, I'm trying to be like, okay, this is going to be so cool. I'm going to have these people connected and there'll be this coincidence from their past. And then it just gets too convoluted when I probably should have just stuck with a premise and been like more laser focused on it. And that's kind of how I felt at the end of the day about this picture, which was unfortunate because it was entertaining me for most of it. And then I just started to feel like, I don't know, there's a lot of things. There's this moment drew me in or this moment drew me in, but then there was like no payoff to it at the end. And I really didn't care at the end of it, to tell you the truth.
Interesting. I can understand that impulse, but I think the film overcomes the contrivances. What I liked about it was it does have that 70s vibe. It does feel very much like that 70s sort of gangster pick kind of exploitation feel. What I liked about it was it kind of flips the script, where it's, because in a lot of those movies it's all about men and being men and you know, standing up for your woman or what you believe in or getting revenge, and it's one man alone against the world, it's Dirty Harry, it's you know, it's all that.
And that's not, and this is the movie about what's happening while the men are out doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like The Godfather, where there are female characters in The Godfather, but, you know, they're not part of the quote unquote action. They are there to complain about, you know, the men not being around or dragging them into lives of violence of things. This is the other side of that story. And what I like about it too is that for much of the film, the main character Jean, she feels like a pinball in the machine. She's like bouncing from one situation to the next. She's trying to figure out what's going on, trying to figure out who's to trust. You know, and there's scenes where what's going on is not exactly clear, and you really get a sense from her point of view. There's a scene where she's in hiding, but she lets somebody in, and you're forced to wonder, is this person a good guy or a bad guy? And there are just enough things to make you think they're a bad guy, but the contrivance is enough that makes you think, are they bad, or are we just like expecting bad things to happen because this is that kind of movie? Yeah. And so the Julia Hart, who's the co-writer and the director, is like really, really smart in terms of keeping you on the edge of your toes like that. Really playing into how Jean is like sort of divorced from all these things going on around her until she gets to a point where she, you know, decides to take agency for herself.
Yeah, I actually the part you're referring to, I thought, was the most compelling part of the movie, is when the lead character Jean, played by Rachel Brosnahan, who people know from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I haven't seen, but I know it's gotten really good reviews. She's in hiding, right? And it's really interesting because I did like early on, like throughout, how nothing's explained, and how you're in the protagonist's mindset where she doesn't know what's going on. Nobody will tell her, like, is her husband alive? Is he in hiding? What happened? What's going on? And she has to go in hiding herself. And I thought the most compelling moment was when her neighbor comes, and this woman who's sweet, but also sort of like sweet in that weird sense, like the neighbors in Rosemary's Baby or something, right? You're just sort of like, okay, is she like just a sweet lady who wants to welcome her to the neighborhood, or is something else going on? And then the neighbor, she says, I was good friends with the people who used to live in this house. Mm-hmm. And Jean invites her in, and they're having dinner. She brings over like some food for Jean, looking out for her, asks about the baby and stuff. And then the neighbor, who apparently was good friends with whoever was in the house before, says, oh, I have to use the washroom. Where is it?
Yeah.
And Jean freaks out. And I freaked out as an audience member. I'm like, what's going to happen now? Right. She's going upstairs. And you can just see Jean freaking out. Like, it's excellent acting in the lead role. And she's just like, you can just sense that character's fear, and you fear as an audience, like, what's going on? She must be like somehow involved with the mob, or something's going on here.
Right.
And then I felt, after all that, like, that itself could have been a movie, or they could have delved deeper into that, you know? And then I felt like what I'm saying, the payoff after that, it just didn't do it for me, you know? Mm-hmm. It just felt like, okay, now we're into something else, and there's some new characters introduced, and here's why people had to go into hiding. And, you know, it would have been just so more thrilling if they'd really delved into that aspect, I thought, at that time, and made it something, just a fuller expression, where the lead character would have to confront the neighbor or something. And there is a payoff, but I just felt like, I don't know.
I thought there was just enough. It was just enough. I think that, because there are so many ways. If there's more to that scene, you start getting into like a definitiveness of like, the old lady was in on it, or no, she wasn't in on it, because it, you know, you can sort of see is she being nosy because she's trying to get close to Jean because she knows this is a mob safe house, and if there's somebody at the safe house, it's maybe something she can exploit? Or is she just like a nosy old lady who lives in the neighborhood who's lonely and is is nosy to compensate for that? When she comes over and she says, "Where's the bathroom?" Is it because she has never been in that house before, or is it because, like a lot of people, she said that the her and the original residents of that house were friends, but they weren't really friends. Like, they waved to each other from the sidewalk, and she embellished on that relationship. Oh, I was great friends with the people who lived here, so she can get her foot in the door because she's the nosy neighbor, and she and Rachel Brosnahan is the new person in the neighborhood. Yeah. It's just, you know, I feel like if there was more meat on the on that sequence, it would just sort of start tearing away the ambiguity, and then the ambiguity is what makes that scene work.
Yeah, I think it makes that scene work, but then, like, from there, like, there's other things, other elements to the film, but that's where it just sort of, it, you know, it sets it up. And I'm a big fan of ambiguity usually, but it just felt like, okay. And that's what had me compelled for the first hour or so. This is 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, this is a pretty, and it's because there's, you know, the slowness to it and stuff, which is great. Like, I actually like that usually, but it just felt like, you know, halfway through, it's like, okay. Right. I get it. Like, let's, and then they tried to, like, sprinkle in, this is where I think, like, I could see the screenplay almost. They're trying to sprinkle in stuff. Okay. Now Cal has a wife and kids, or, and here they are, and here this, you know, and it just, I don't know if she was on her own, the lead character, Jean, just trying to navigate, if there's even more ambiguity in a way, if it was just sort of streamlined in a way where, you know, you're just fearing for what's going to happen to her. And she's just like in charge of the whole thing, which I know she's the protagonist, but then you bring in all these other characters. I just felt like it wasn't focused enough, really. I thought at the end of the day, and it didn't make me really care at the end that much as I probably should have. I just didn't. I cared that her and her baby would be safe, but I wasn't, I don't know, all these other characters involved, it just felt, I don't know, a little bit too contrived for me.
Well, I can see that, but I think one of the things about this movie is that it is, and maybe this is getting to what you're saying about being able to see the writing process, is that, you know, all of these characters probably in a different crime movie, like, maybe don't make it out alive. Like, maybe Jean makes it out alive because Eddie comes, her husband comes in at the end and is able to save her, and they barely escape. And that's kind of like the, I don't know, like the Sugarland Express kind of ending, where they become folk heroes and are able to get out alive or something. But, like, you know, for Cal and Terry, two people of color, by the way, and Jean as the wife who is in the dark, it is all about, I think, not to put words into Julia Hart's mouth, but this idea that a lot of 70s movies are about last man standing, like about killing everybody so that you're the last man standing and you can get out. We see the reversal play in this, where the only way these characters get out is by teaming up and by, you know, not falling into the usual patterns. Like, it would be super easy for Cal to just, like, after, you know, delivering Jean to the safe house, to just, like, walk away. Because he doesn't, I mean, he owed Eddie the answering his phone call and then doing what he asked. He doesn't owe Eddie, like, coming back and saving Jean later on. Terry certainly doesn't owe Eddie anything. And she'd be well within her rights to say to Cal, like, hey, forget this white woman. you have your wife and your son and your father right here. Let's just focus on us. Let's focus on us getting out. And, you know, what we see in the course of the film is that these people sort of bank on each other and supporting each other, as opposed to going full Dog Day Afternoon with every man for himself. And again, that writing may be on the wall, but it's a perspective I did find compelling in the end.
Yeah, I think it's interesting turning, and I'm a big fan of turning anything on its head and changing, you know, changing the gender roles or changing. I think that's really cool when you can do that. I felt in this circumstance, though, it just like I'm saying, I liked the characters. I liked the acting, mm-hmm. and I was compelled. I thought I really liked the character of Cal and, of course, Gene in the lead role. But then it was just sort of, okay. And then at the end, it's like, okay, now here's another dangerous group of mobsters after them here now, you know? Here they are. Here's another one. Here's another. You know, it's just, I don't know. To me, it was just, I did like one thing. I like the slow reveals about, you know, what happened to Eddie or what's going on here and there. I like that, and the fact that right. It wasn't like overblown or okay, he comes back in a convertible right. once they're shooting people or something. You know, I don't need that, but I just felt like there was a lot. In a way, there's almost like too much going on without enough going on. If you know what I'm saying, there's like too many ideas about okay, these people are. Here's how they relate to each other, and here's what happened, and then at the same time there's very little action except at the end, I guess, right?
Well, I mean, it's one thing to say about what, you know, Julia Hart, she is like super dedicated to Gene's perspective, so we never really go outside of Gene's perspective. We don't you know, we don't see flashbacks of, you know, Eddie's life as a thief. We don't get any insights there. We don't see Eddie's apparent death, or really kind of understand like how he died. And there's that scene at the, I guess it's a club. It's like a roller rink club or something like that, where they go to get information about Cal's whereabouts, her and Terry. And some mobsters come in and start, you know, shooting people. And you never see, like this would be the time where another director would be like, here's the action, like, here's the John Woo, like, slow motion gunfire stuff. And Julia Hart does not engage in that at all. It is seen entirely from Gene's perspective that she's hiding in a phone booth. and it's just, what I did appreciate that aspect of it. It's like, yeah, we are sacrificing not getting all the information we want, or necessarily to like trusting the information when it's given to us. Like when Cal just says like, hey, Eddie's dead. Like, did Cal do it? I think that's implied. We don't know that for sure though, because we certainly know that Cal's capable of killing, but we don't know that he pulled the trigger. And you know, it's, there's a certain skill to that. I mean, and it's a kind of restraint too, to not have to not go into where the big action is in order to maintain that perspective. And I think it shows an enormous amount of self-control on Julia Hart's part, that she was staying right next to Gene the whole time through the whole movie.
Yeah, there's definitely restraint there. You're talking about the disco scene. Yeah, you're thinking, okay, here's the disco scene. Here's the Scarface disco scene, or
yeah,
something,
yeah, yeah.
Or, yeah, Carlito's Way or something, and you don't get that, which you're not really expecting given the way the tone of the movie up till that point. But sure. Still, you're not. Yeah, it's so restrained, which is funny because I usually like stuff that's a little more restrained and slow. But this, I don't know. I could have used a real disco blowout scene there, you know, and it was sort of, yeah. But you're saying it's. Yeah, it's her point of view, so.
It feels like there might have been, like, a studio note in there. I don't know how big Amazon is into giving notes to its filmmakers, but, you know, it feels like that in a different circumstance would have been a studio note that would have been something to the effect of, like, can't someone come into the roller rink with a bazooka or something? And You know, just to take... So we have something to put in the trailer.
The neighbor should have come in with a machine gun.
That's there. Right.
It solves everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Cal comes in and he rescues Jean and unties the old lady. It turns out she's in on it the whole time and she's got an AK-47 hidden in her cane or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It feels like in lesser hands, that's a direction this would have gone into for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... but at the same time, like, I liked it, but it's not something... Actually, I didn't like it. I told you I didn't like it, but there were moments I liked. There were moments I liked the film, but I wouldn't... Yeah. Wouldn't want to even watch it again. It wasn't one of those ones where I just didn't get it or something, or I didn't get the perspective. I just felt like it. It's weird because, like, it's probably a movie like on a scale of 1 to 10 or something. I'd probably give like a 6 or something too. But that's often maybe the worst movies for me because it's like it had potential, and then I just felt like it didn't totally follow through with what it could have done really. I think, you know,
I think you could have easily shaved off like 10 or 15 minutes. Like there's a lot of, like sitting and waiting for stuff to happen that I don't need to see, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point where Terry and Jean get separated after the disco shootout. And, I feel like there's some stuff that we could have shaved down to make this like a tighter 105 minutes. But, there's also something to the need for finality too. Because there's a scene where near the end where Jean finally meets up with Mike, this guy who's been fighting with Eddie for turf in this gang war that's going on. I think the film's set in Pittsburgh. Well, at least they shot it in Pittsburgh. But you know, we finally meet this Mike character who we've heard about through the whole film, who's like sending legions of henchmen to find Eddie and to chase Jean and the baby down. And it seemed like they basically ripped that character right out of Reservoir Dogs, because he's like this like greasy, foul-mouthed guy in a leather jacket. Like 20 years ago, he probably would have been paid, but it would have been played by Tom Savini. Because Tarantino loves 70s movies so much. I had that Tarantino feeling through much of the film, except Julia Hart doesn't care about the exploitation stuff. But
yeah,
this was the moment where it's like, okay, you've been waiting for it. We've been kind of like engaging in this world for the last 100 some odd minutes. Now we're going into full Tarantino character with this loathsome character who is who's, you know, telling his henchmen to shut up. And when that doesn't work, he shoots him in the face. And it's like, okay, we get it. Mike's a bad guy. And that, I mean, that part of it kind of took me out of it for a minute, because we've been building atmosphere for like almost 2 solid hours. And then we drop this cartoon character into it. And it's like, you know, if this was, I hope this isn't what we were building up to. I understand that, you know, the impulse was to go here. Mike is a loathsome character, and we get that from a lot of the insights throughout the film. It didn't break the film. I kind of forgive the sequence given everything else I enjoyed about the film, but I mean, I could have done without Mike in the end.
Yeah, kind of like a cartoon character at the end. And yeah, that's also I think the impulse, like, I'm like a really big fan of like 70s movies, ones that are really low key. Like, I think there's a movie like Fat City that John Huston did, or, you know, there's Harry and Tonto. There's these ones, and they just have a vibe to them. And so then, but often nowadays, people make a 70s movie and they think of the fashion, or, you know, there's a disco scene in it, you know, but they don't do yeah. a lot in the disco, but it's like, oh, we'll put a disco in here. Everybody will have wear bell bottoms and wide lapels, and that's it. And this movie luckily wasn't too much like that, but there's a little bit like that. And then I think that came out some of the characters too, maybe like character like Mike, you know, like they're the stereotypical 70s gangster or whatever. And this movie does avoid it, but I think there is sort of a surface level still there. It's not as bad as like American Hustle was or something.
Yeah.
You know, but it's luckily it didn't go fully down that road, but you can still sense it. It's still kind of superficial in a way. I guess that'd be another criticism I'd have, but like underneath that, at least the character, you can feel for the character and their strong acting and strong dialogue from the Jean character. So you can really understand what she's going through, which helps ground the movie. So it's not just a fluff, stylish 70s piece. So that's good. Yeah. And they didn't go fully down that road, but I still feel there is that air, a bit of superficiality about it too. And you see that at the opening scene, obviously, like she's the housewife with the new clothes, right? The 70s fashion outfit and the tags getting stuck in her chair and a little bit of humor there.
I thought that was more meant to understood that she's kind of living this fake life wearing stolen clothes that her husband procures. And it's kind of a color commentary about the fakeness, maybe not of the era. I mean, the 70s wasn't a particularly consumerist time, there's something going on there about just the fakeness of their life, that she is this bored housewife who is living off the fruits of Eddie's criminal activities. And I guess it's maybe kind of a Carmela Soprano vibe where she kind of hates it, but she takes part in it just the same, as by being the understanding wife of a gangster.
Yeah. And that's sort of a stereotype, obviously, at this point, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in The Sopranos, but in a lot of other gangster movies. You think of, like, Goodfellas and a lot of those movies. That's kind of the role. But I think she does transcend it. And it's given from from a different point of view, which is interesting. There's a great movie. It's a good movie. That you did called Gloria with Jenna Rollins. And she's kind of in this circumstance where people are getting killed by the mob. And then she's has to look after this kid. He's older than a baby, but now she's a mob mole that has to take care of a kid. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that was probably an inspiration too. A lot of inspiration like that. And yeah, it's good to see it from a different perspective. I just felt like almost like less is more in how much it branched out into these different characters and then have a little more meat to it. Like a real disco blowout scene would have been good.
I don't want to say it was perfect the way it was, because I think there are some legitimate critiques. But I thought this was a winning movie. I think Rachel Brosnahan is really great. I have not seen Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, no matter how often Amazon Studios or Amazon Prime Video says I should. I do remember seeing her like pop up on things like The Blacklist in season one and like House of Cards in season one, and just like looking at her and thinking all the time, you are too good for this. Like that, those shows, as swanky and you know, as well put together as they are like really not great shows. But she was next level, and so I'm glad to see that she gets a showcase like this where, she can be vulnerable and determined and ferocious, and I think Jean has a very believable arc in this. It's not like she becomes like Sarah Connor in The Terminator by the end, but it is a very believable turn where she has gone from this place. And there's this great monologue where she explains how she couldn't have children and how she saw it as punishment because she married Eddie, who's essentially a wicked man. And how she just kind of accepted that, and how she kind of just accepted being this, I guess, like a gangster's mall, just like being a prop in her own life, and how that kind of turns when she tells Terry that she's going to come with her to back to the city to find Cal, and then when she takes matters into her own hands when Mike picks her up, and even just in the scene where Cal tells her that Eddie's dead, and she's like, okay, well, you know what, we'll get out of the city, I'll find a job and raise the baby and in peace somewhere else. And I found her so compelling, I guess I was able to come along on the journey, even if there were at times the movie felt it was dragging a little, or some of the other people they were encountering were a little too cartoony, or whatever the criticisms were. I think she makes the film, Rachel Brosnahan, and I think that this is another check mark on her star making rise. So
for sure, yeah, I could see her in a lot of different roles going forward, and she definitely has a platform for it now. So
mm-hmm. She's the face of Amazon.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if she is comfortable in that, but I think it's like the little smiley face on the boxes in Rachel Brosnahan.
Yeah. Yeah, she's taking over. Soon she'll be on the box too.
Maybe.
Hey, that's a place for advertising. Do they don't hey there's an idea for Amazon.
We should have taken that off air, because now they'll definitely steal it. And
they will. They're listening.
Well, they have to. I mean, we are on... I don't know if we're available on any Amazon platform, but yeah, they could be. You never know. It's Echelon now, or Amazon is tuned in to find any mention of their name on any streaming audio anywhere, and then it locks in, and you know, then you end up on a watch list or something. The Amazon
ready
watch
to
list.
Destroy your life. Yeah. After
that. Oh, you want your foot cream delivered next day? Maybe it'll take 5 days.
Maybe your neighbor's going to get some new foot cream.
we're going to send your neighbor two doors down a brand new $800 crib, and we're charging it to your card.
It's what they'll do if we mention their name, unless we praise them. But they're good. It's good service. We watched this on Prime, right? It was Amazon Prime, because I forgot at the beginning. Okay, yeah. Amazon Prime's great.
I have no complaints about Prime. But, I mean, that's probably too late to undo the damage. all right, let's get off the air before we really honk them off. Tim, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they get in touch with you?
Flash in the Deadpan on social media.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it as always, and if you would like to listen to it again, you can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for almost all the music you hear on the End Credit Show. Just open up their Spotify app and search End Credits on CFRU and save that playlist, because we do update it every week. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.